It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter here on WGN Radio on, well, it's dead of winter in Chicago. Should be cold. Maybe not this cold. Ice fishermen, unless you have an ice fishing hut with a big heater, probably not a great time to go ice fishing. This was always, years ago, when I hunted in the deep south, something you looked for. The big freeze pushing birds all the way south. Here we are at the end of January, the end of hunting seasons, and we have it. This is also important weather in the far as controlling, believe it or not, insects and pests. The agricultural community needs deep freezes to kill many insects. So when we have this kind of weather, it actually is doing a favor to agriculture in that so many insects and bugs that make it through milder winters cannot make it through this kind of weather. So it is it's a blessing in a way for agriculture right now. And when it comes to birds, as long as you don't have a lot of snow and ice, which we have both of in certain parts of the country, cold weather does not affect birds. Pheasants just puff up and climb under something in a hay bale or wherever it is. Same with quail. They have a natural mechanism to deal with cold. What they don't have is a natural mechanism to deal with ice. And a big ice storm has worked its way across the midsection of the country, and that will kill a lot of birds, not just quail and pheasants. It will kill millions of songbirds. They are unable to feed when there's ice. And in parts of Tennessee and Mississippi and Arkansas and Texas and over into Georgia and Alabama, that whole swath, the Carolinas, huge ice storms. That ice basically makes it so birds are unable to feed. And the same thing happens for deer. Although deer are able to browse and get above the ice line, if you will, and still get buds off of trees and eat brush and eat grass. That's not true of birds that are dependent on seeds on the ground, which get buried under the ice. So this is a very difficult storm at a time of the year when birds are vulnerable anyway. And the last thing we need is more birds in peril. Right now, with the declining bird populations of which we're all aware, this definitely is a blow to them. I want to move on to something that came up in Davos this week. And no, I'm not going to do a show on Davos, the Davos Economic Forum, but I'm going to draw it back to something that happened years ago here and then again to today. So in Davos, the thing that was missing, according to all reports, was no talk about climate change and global warming. And Davos has served as the platform for much of the discussion about wind farms and solar and all the alternative energy sources that have to do with climate change, trying to stop a warming planet. There was very little of that this year. Why do I mention this? Because it's an economic forum. And I would like to offer here on the Great Outdoors Show a bit of a perspective that I think is worth discussing. And that is, early on in President Bush, George W. Bush's first term, in his State of the Union address, he devoted a considerable portion of his address to renewable energy, biofuels, and biodiesel. And for those of you who may remember, I remember it well, it came out of the blue. He announced at his State of the Union that the United States was going to grow tens of millions of acres of switchgrass and other grasses that would be used for biodiesel and biofuels, renewable energy, and that this acreage would come at the expense of corn acreage and soybean acreage and wheat acreage, particularly those areas that were not great yielding grounds. And the focus of his speech was on growing grass on the prairies, which were America's grassland. And for a couple of years thereafter, it went full throttle. we were going to have maybe 40 or 50 million acres of grass, bigger than the Conservation Reserve Program had ever been. And it would be renewable energy, and it would be sustainable conservation. What happened to it? It ended. Why did it end? Because the agro-industrial complex ganged up and killed it. There's not a single producer in the agricultural community who makes equipment, sells seed, sells fertilizer, combines, who runs a grain elevator, who wanted to see tens of millions of acres of productive land, in the view of productive, meaning corn, soybeans, wheat, come out of quote-unquote production and be used to produce energy. Because when you plant switchgrass, you plant it once and maybe 20 years later, you go in and replant it. There's chemicals, the no chemicals. When you plant all kinds of the grasses that were envisioned to be replanted across the Great Plains, it was a one-time deal. And you didn't need to have any of the equipment to harvest them, different equipment. Combines will be retrofitted, but grain elevators weren't going to be selling biodiesel. That was going to go to refineries. So the complex that is the industrial agricultural complex in America killed this notion that we would have renewable energy in America. A portion of our energy would come from products that were grown on perennial, not annual. So corn planted every year, they would love for corn to become a biodiesel fuel because it's planted, it's harvested, it has to be replanted. Not so much for grass. In fact, totally opposed to grass, which is also what killed the Conservation Reserve Program. The communities did not want the Conservation Reserve Program to exist any longer because it wasn't producing money into the rural economies. Grain elevators weren't being used, seed wasn't being purchased, all those kinds of things. And so the result was President Bush's vision of beginning a renewable energy based in America, based in agricultural lands, based on the prairies, which have been absolutely fantastic for water quality, soil erosion, and air quality, ended. So here we are today, some 20 plus years later, and President Trump and the U.S. Forest Service are working on a new plan to have energy come from wood products, to have sustainable energy in America, biofuels, biodiesel, and it's to come from wood. This would mean that wood products and the residue from wood products will be used for fuel. Right now, less than 1% of America's fuel, I believe, comes from wood products generation. That's far less than coal, far less than nuclear, obviously a lot less than oil and gas. But there's the potential for a fairly significant portion of America's energy to come from renewable fuels to do with timber. The question is, will the same thing happen to timber that happened to agriculture over 20 years ago when President Bush said we're going to have agriculture produce renewable fuels? Will timber be able to produce renewable fuels, or will the other interests that are so entrenched stop that because it means timber won't be used for other things? I think in this case, the answer is no, because the timber industry is not the same as the corn lobby, the soybean lobby, the cotton lobby, all these lobbies that exist to produce more grain in America. And these grains come, obviously, they provide cheap food for the world, but they also come at an enormous environmental cost. That's not the case with timber. So in the coming couple of months, be on the lookout, and I'll certainly mention it to you. The Forest Service is going to, I believe, with the administration and the Department of Agriculture, announce a major initiative at having sustainable fuels come from timber. We'll see if the same behind-the-scenes maneuvering takes place that killed President Bush's initiative to have sustainable fuel come from agriculture. We'll find out. But sustainable fuel in America can come from a lot of places, and not all of it comes from solar and wind farms, and not all of it can come from oil and gas. We can actually have sustainable fuel using products here in America that involve agriculture and timber. I'll be back after the break with much more on the great outdoors. And when I do, I'm going to talk about what's happened in Canada when it comes to hunting in Canada and how difficult it's becoming, and a couple of other things to do in the Great Outdoors Show. Thanks so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. I have to tell you that hunting in Canada is just not as easy as it used to be, nor is it as much fun as it used to be when it comes to after you've left Canada, what you have to go through. So this past fall, as I have for absolutely the last 45 years, I went to Canada, to Saskatchewan, to go hunting. And returned to the United States, no problem. And then I started to get in my spam folder, apparently. I didn't get the emails from the province of Saskatchewan demanding that I fill out a form telling them where I hunted in Saskatchewan, how many birds I shot, et cetera, et cetera. Not that I'm opposed to that at all. It helps them get information. What I am opposed to is that they used email and it went to a spam folder. And then I found out that I had missed the quote unquote mandatory period to comply. And that would put in jeopardy my ability to get a hunting license for Saskatchewan next year because I did not reply to emails that went directly to spam. And I don't know if I'm like a lot of you, but I don't check my spam folder regularly. I get enough email that's spam without having to check my spam folder to see if I actually have real email in my spam. So with technology being what it is, we've lost so much of the personal human touch. And in Saskatchewan's case, I think they've taken it a step too far to say, if you don't reply to our surveys, you can't get a hunting license in the future in Saskatchewan. But they don't let you know necessarily. They don't reach out to you. They don't mail you anything. It's all done electronically. And if you don't get it, as I didn't, you could be out of luck. We'll see what happens. I've got a call into the Ministry of Saskatchewan to find out what I'm going to do about it. But apparently I now am not on the list. I'm on the list of people who can't buy a license next year in Saskatchewan because I didn't reply to a survey. I don't know how many people across America have no idea they were supposed to reply to a survey to hunt in Saskatchewan if they did this past year, but I have a feeling quite a few are going to be in for a surprise when they go next fall to buy their Saskatchewan license and they find out they can't because they didn't comply with a mandatory survey they didn't know about. So it's one of those things where I think the province of Saskatchewan, I rather hope the Ministry of Wildlife in Saskatchewan realizes that this is not a very customer-friendly way to deal with people who've been supporting Saskatchewan for a long time. We'll see what happens. I'll actually let you know when I get through to the minister and find out what's going to happen. Speaking of what's going to happen with the few minutes I have left, who knows what's going to happen with Colorado wolf release. So the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, which announced it will not release gray wolves this winter after failing to secure a source animal, and being told by the Fish and Wildlife Service that it could not release animals, wolves, into Colorado anymore because of the fact that these wolves genetically are not the same as the wolves that were once there. The wolves that were once there are extinct, and are not able to be brought back. So the genetics of these wolves that I talked about a few weeks ago are different. They're larger. They come from further north. They have a much greater impact on wildlife populations, and therefore the result is that the Fish and Wildlife Service said you can't have them. It's now heating up as a state's rights issue versus a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issue. So we're going to see what happens, but the entire wolf recovery, as they call it, program in the West is in question. For a lot of people, it's not a recovery program. It's an out-of-control program in that you take what's happened around Yellowstone Park with wolves, the wolf pack in Yellowstone, and how it's moved out of the park and has affected wildlife populations. And for many people who had elk hunting on their ranches on the north side of Yellowstone, up in Gardner and Livingston area and across the whole range of north of Yellowstone, the Bridger Range and all of that, there are now very few elk. And people for generations have had elk to hunt, and now the wolves have taken them out. Can you say this is nature rebalancing? That elk were far too populous, and that deer were too populous because the wolves were gone? You could make that case, but now the pendulum has swung the other way, and it appears to be there are a lot more wolves than maybe they ever thought they could be, and their impact on the big game population is rather extraordinary. So we'll stay tuned with what's happening in Colorado. One last thing before I sign off for the day. This cold weather, as I talked about, really can hit birds with the ice, not the cold weather, but the ice and the snow, which then freezes over. What's happened in the American West, interestingly, after one of the slowest migrations in anyone's recollection, is suddenly all kinds of birds, not just waterfowl, but all kinds of birds are migrating south through the Intermountain West. This is only about 6 weeks later than should have happened. So the question is, where have all these birds been? Have they all been still up in Canada? I mean, robins and those birds are supposed to migrate with daylight. And yet all of a sudden they're migrating flocks of robins and blackbirds moving through 6 weeks later than would be ordinary. We're learning things about birds that we never thought possible. And I think we're also learning that as agriculture changes and as climate changes, birds are adapting very quickly. I'll be back with much more on the Great Outdoors show next Sunday morning. And for you ice fishermen, have at it this week. You got ice that's going to be as thick as you've seen in a long time. Thanks so much for listening. I will not be joining you, by the way, on the ice. Thanks so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.